The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the podcast that takes all of the bits and bytes from the world of technology and turns them into a giant meme. I'm Alex Kratosky. And speaking of memes, I've been passively playing the passively multiplayer online game, and my activities have recently taken me down the rabbit hole of bizarre conferences, the most appealing of which is RaffleCon, a celebration of all the strange things people pass around to one another online, from lolcats to videos of the Star Wars kid. If you're interested, it happens in Boston in April. Joining me in the studio to tap into the mainframe are Charles Arthur and Bobby Johnson. What's your favourite internet meme?
I'm a big fan of lolcats like everybody else. You know, a bit of ICANN has a bit of cheeseburger. That would do me. But I'm actually going to RaffleCon,
so I
might come up with all kinds of new
lots of people
memes.
Stroking cats.
Yes. They're all going to be there.
Oh, my favourite is the flying spaghetti monster, which is if intelligent design should be taught in school, then so should the flying spaghetti monster, which is, of course, the creator of all things.
Exactly. Prove to me that he does not exist and I'll give you $1 million.
Let him touch you with his noodly appendage.
Pastafarians unite. Oh, we're such geeks in this pod. Anyway, it's not all frippery and nonsense here on Tech Weekly. No, this is a serious podcast. And to prove the point, we're speaking with author and internet pundit Clay Shirky about the social and economic implications of the web. We're also delving into the past to learn about the future, the first of our retro features on the implications of the BBC Micro on today's British technology industry. It's a packed show, but somehow we've made room to talk about the news and to open up our brand new VoIP hotline. Stay tuned to hear how you can be heard on future Tech Weeklies. Welcome to the show. Clay Shirky is one of the U.S.'s most celebrated digital authors. His writings on the internet have inspired and defined academic and enterprise approaches to online engagement, and his latest book, Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations, gives to the little person what he's been giving to business for almost a decade. Charles, you spoke with Clay. What did he have to say?
Well, Alex, I began by talking to him about whether social tools are getting easier to use because they now cost nothing.
It's really the cost in sort of all the ways you could use the word cost, the dollar cost or the pound cost, but it's also the difficulty, the hassle factor. Great example is the HSBC protest of last summer, right? HSBC goes out and tries to recruit students and recent graduates in the UK by saying, we'll give you a checking account, penalty free, good deal, right? They sign up a lot of people. And then over the summer, right, after the students have all dispersed, they say, oh, you know what? We've changed our minds. Actually, you're going to owe us a penalty. You've got 30 days to change, right? And the two things that HSBC counted on were the students couldn't easily get information about how to switch banks, and they couldn't get together to do anything about it, no matter how mad they were. But they hadn't counted on Facebook. So a guy named Wes Streeting puts up a page on Facebook, says, stop the great HSBC ripoff. They get thousands of people to join, right? And suddenly, this group has come together in a way that HSBC wasn't counting on. And not for any money, but in order to earn the appreciation of their peers and to be good community members, people start putting up incredibly detailed instructions, right? If you want to switch from HSBC to this other bank, here's how you do it. So the information advantage that HSBC thought they had, now gone. And then this student said, you know what? This is a protest movement. We're going to start having these virtual protests. Seeing how well that went, they then said, we're going to go down to the city in the flesh and march around in front of HSBC's headquarters. And that protest never happened because HSBC caved in, right? The two things that HSBC thought it knew, two things that used to be true, were a business and really any formal institution has an advantage for both managing information and taking coordinated action. And what Facebook added to the equation was it took a much larger, much more distributed group and it gave them those tools as well. The previous monopoly on coordination no longer applies only to institutions.
But it's an interesting question, isn't it? That if HSBC had sort of stood firm against it and said, oh, people on Facebook, who cares? And had said, you know, let's see if you're actually prepared to go down and protest. That would be the sort of the real test, wouldn't it, of the loose organization?
It would certainly be a test in a political environment. And there are lots of examples of real world political protests. for businesses, of course, the loss of the custom of those students was also the threat. So in a way, they caved even before this protest came about because there was another avenue, right, which is that the customers could simply switch to other banks. And they were, you know, they were essentially hemorrhaging people, hemorrhaging customers. When it's a purely political situation, though, you do need this physical mobilization.
What about businesses? Can businesses use these tools? Can businesses benefit from
these
tools?
There's really two places where businesses can take advantage of this. One of the places is when you're a large company, actually allowing people to coordinate internally to affect strategy might well be a good idea. I mean, this is true in a much more tragic way also of the Challenger disaster where we, Columbia, where we had a space shuttle blow up killing the crew and blow up needlessly because the engineers looking at the problem understood what was wrong in a way that management didn't. Management will be loath on one level to do this for obvious reasons, and yet it may be a good idea to allow employees to have a kind of group voice. There's a fascinating moment that comes when instead of just back and forth conversations, you start to get a kind of shared awareness, an awareness that not only do you have a particular feeling, but that everybody else around you shares the same concerns. And what seems to me to have happened in Vista is that many people privately knew that shipping Vista in its current form and against the current hardware specifications was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. And yet, because the corporate direction said this is what we're driving for, none of those private objections managed to congeal into this group sensibility. Had they been able to harness the internal community in a way that they weren't when it was all hierarchical and command and control, they might have saved themselves a big corporate debacle. The other possibility, though, which is quite interesting, is that things that operate in this kind of communal world, instead of having big splashy launches, tend to start very modestly and build up. You know, Wikipedia or Linux, the open source software system, when you go back and you find the original message that launched either of them, it's incredibly modest. But what that message suggests is that instead of lowering the likelihood of failure, you should just lower the cost of failure and then increase the amount of failure. Right now, Microsoft's testing process in the outside world involves sort of heavily vetted technical professionals. But of course, those are exactly the people who, when they get a driver error, they know what to do. Had they allowed someone's mom and dad to buy one of these Vista machines and seen that, in fact, the expectation for the software was off of what it was, had they done this in a kind of, you know, increasingly open way and reacted to the feedback rather than saying, it's going to be completely secret up until the day everybody has it, they could also have avoided one of the debacles. Now, it reduces the PR value, right? You don't get to send out the big fancy press release about today's launch day, but it increases the technical value, which, you know, in my mind, is what Microsoft should have been selling all along.
The other question that arises, these groups can form very quickly, but equally they dissipate very quickly.
Previously, pressure groups, you know, classically unions, NGOs, what have you, had to exist in advance of a crisis in order to have the resources and the coordination to respond to the crisis. Part of the rise of these protest groups that sort of spawn quickly, take action, and then dissipate is simply that pattern is now possible. So we're seeing most of the novelty there.
But they come up faster and faster, but they also disappear.
Right, exactly.
Faster and faster.
The single issue pressure group is actually more effective because it's nonpartisan and surprising. And so the political system, right, has a way of essentially co-opting and ultimately cooperating with an NGO. That it comes in from the outside with very strong demands, but then there's some compromising and eventually it kind of gets brought into the system.
That was Clay Shirky. So, Charles, tell me a little bit more about this approach to social media, the use of social media and activism and clearly organizing organizations.
Well, his idea is that as these social tools for organizing, for creating almost random self-governing organizations become more widespread, that everyone will start doing it. And that you really start to see the effects when you don't notice that those tools are there.
As you said before, he mentions things like, you know, Flickr groups and all these kinds of Web 2.0. My favorite example of social activism via a Flickr group is there was a bunch of people who were really anti-Humvees, the U.S. car. And there's this classic example of somebody flicking off a a Humvee, and it now belongs to the group FUH2. Exactly. And people all around the world have stood in front of these giant yellow monstrosities, for want of a better word, with their middle fingers pointing at them.
We've always talked a lot about the potential for technology to affect or help affect a political change. And people have always kind of been scratching around for examples. They know it's going to be there at some point. But, you know, we maybe talk about the Philippines bumping Estrada a few years ago by organising themselves by text message, that kind of thing. And having, you know, recently had the protests in Tibet and before that the Burmese situation, you can kind of see how technologies can be used to try and subvert political oppression. Whether it actually works in the way that Clay imagines or wants or believes it can, I think we may be a way away from that.
Yes, I think he really is a believer, but at the same time, I think we've seen a lot of these ways that people have organized themselves before, and this isn't necessarily the elixir that is going to create a hugely activist and an effective population.
There are sort of two divergent points. The point about political repression is that it takes a lot of organization, whereas being politically disobedient is something that takes minimal organization, and the tools that we have now make it easier to be part of that minimally organized group. When it comes to thinking about trying to get these minimally organized groups to actually have political effect, that equally is more difficult as well. How can he looks at Howard Dean, for example, in his book, and he gives the example where Howard Dean in the 2004 Democratic primaries, everyone thought he's going to be the candidate. It's all amazing, but this minimally organized group he had around him didn't have enough political leverage to actually interest the people beyond that minimally organized group. It had no political leverage.
Well, you've also got Anonymous, who I think are a really interesting gang, who are basically the anti-Scientology campaigners, and they've been organizing themselves into kind of ad hoc protests and attempts to diss Tom Cruise and all his cronies. And I think, you know, these things do have an effect. But I suppose the obvious thing is that the less organised you are, the harder it is to organise. Does that make any sense? No. But what you gain a benefit from being more spread out, especially in a politically repressive situation, because, you know, you can't pin it on one person. But that has its own concomitant problems.
Well, thank you very much. And you can find out more in Clay's book, Here Comes Everybody, which you can get at guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Now, we've tracked Jemima down this week. We found her from her many adventures around the world, and we've brought her back into the pod. So, Jemima, what's been happening in the news this week?
Chinese authorities have been widely condemned for blocking foreign coverage of unrest in Tibet, with The Guardian, Yahoo and YouTube all affected. At the same time, access to the English version of the BBC news site appears to have been relaxed, although the Chinese version remains blocked inside the country. Google has written to the US government to push for spare TV spectrum to be freed up for wireless internet services. The web giant said the spectrum would not interfere with TV signals and could create a Wi-Fi dividend that would be running by the end of next year. British kids spend more than 20 hours a week online and are being raised by the internet, according to research. Preempting the forthcoming government report led by Tanya Byron, the Institute of Public Policy Research warns that parents are often oblivious to the online lives of their children. The world's computing power should be driven by renewable energy, said Cambridge professor Andy Hopper. The UK's computer business is responsible for more than 550 million tonnes of CO2 emissions each year, but Hopper says that server farms are transferable and should be sited near wind farms.
That's all for the news for now. You can read these stories and more on our website, guardian.co.uk/technology. Twenty-five years ago, the BBC launched an initiative to bring home computing to the masses. Its BBC Micro, the first affordable home computing system, was the serious system for the discerning parent. And while the machine had games galore, its proper applications were the selling point for countless tie-ins with BBC programmes. It is, without a doubt, the inspiration for the countless bedroom programmers who have made the computing and computer gaming industry that exists in this country today. Bobby, you went to the Science Museum last week to speak with the people who brought it together. What happened?
Well, this was an event put on by the Computer Conservation Society to celebrate the BBC Micro. They had a display there which had a load of vintage machines and games playing on them. They even had a gold-plated BBC Micro for anyone who was really into it. And this is all ahead of an exhibition that they'll be putting on in 2009 to celebrate, really, the birth of the British computer industry. Now, I spoke to Tilly Blythe, who's the curator, John Radcliffe, who's one of the BBC producers who is behind this pioneering scheme, and Herman Hauser, one of the brains at Acorn. And I started by asking Herman kind of how this all came about in the first place.
Well, it all started with John Radcliffe at the BBC and his Merry Men conceiving that it was time to educate the British public about computing. And they came to see us with a specification, which was a very advanced and very ambitious specification. And we tried our best to fulfill that specification and won the contract in competition with six other companies that were bidding for it.
And so John, I mean, what spurred you on to do that in the first place? What was your primary motivation?
Well, it was evident, first of all, in 1980-81 that computers and computing were going to be extremely important. And therefore, we said to ourselves, we should probably do something big on this. The second thing was that we went out and did a fairly large piece of research to see what people wanted among the general population. We thought the interest would be confined mainly to men, mainly between 20 and 35, mainly professional people with degrees. In fact, it was an interest that spread right through the population. So we were going to have to do a project that served the general audience. That was going to be 10 television programs. Now, we knew that you can't teach people very much with television programs. What you can do is to interest them in things, and you can teach them a little bit. So we knew that alongside the television programs, there had to be books and courses and information systems, but there also needed, in this case, to be a microcomputer, so that people could get their hands on a computer and program it and make it do things for themselves, because there's nothing like getting your hands on a machine to make a leap forward in understanding what this thing is.
Herman, do you think, what was it that was special, apart from the motivation and the grand plan behind it, was there anything special about the machine itself over and above its competitors?
Yes, it was far and above the best machine in the market at the time. So it was the first machine that mixed graphics and text on a colour screen. It was the first machine to have a network connection as standard. It was the first machine that actually had a sophisticated operating system long before MS-DOS. And it was just leading the world also in speed. Our computer ran twice as fast as the Apple II, which at that time was one of the leading machines.
And Tilly Blythe, you're the curator of this event, and I believe you're also writing a book about the BBC Micro. What do you think the long-term influence of it was, if anything?
I think there's a number of influences, really. One of them was a kind of major cultural change that was caused by the microprocessor, and as part of that, the BBC Micro machine. So you really see a generation of people who grew up using the BBC Micro and learning to program and understanding computers, being very familiar with computers and seeing that really as a career option, you know, going forward to become programmers, which is why we now have, you know, the fourth biggest industry in computer games development in the world. We're very strong in interactive media, you know, so I think there's a whole generational change that happened there.
Was that something you envisaged, John, when you were starting out, that, you know, 30 years down the line, there'd still be remnants of this thing out there?
Well, we were more concerned with surviving the next 25 days, actually, at the time. But what I would say is that what we got in our machine was the technology at one stage. But looking further ahead, I remember, Herman, looking on to 16-bit processors, looking on to all sorts of convergences down the line. And indeed, those convergences happened. And the result has been a very powerful, high-tech nucleus of companies around Cambridge, growing out of that Acorn tradition, which in fact is producing world-class technology.
Do you think if you were coming to this situation today and looking at it, are there any areas where you'd like to reenact history in some way, or Do you think it would be possible to do so?
Well, to tell you the truth, I've been reflecting on that. Modern computers are very, very fast, and they're kind of closed boxes, really. You don't need to find out what's inside them too much. You run software on them. On the other hand, I do actually believe that there's nothing like getting your hands on one and programming it to do something to make you actually understand what it is and what it consists of. And so I would like to see this happening in schools probably more than it does.
That's a point really, Herman, isn't it? Because, you know, getting your hands dirty with the guts of a machine just doesn't happen in schools anymore. Would you like to see that take place?
Absolutely, and I get lots of complaints from computing departments all over the country that they now take in people from schools that haven't programmed in BBC Basic anymore because their PCs, which replaced Acorn computers, of course, if you want to program in Visual Basic, it is much, much harder than in the original BBC Basic. What I think needs to happen, and I'm quoting Bill Buxton here, my friend who is professor of computer science at Toronto University, and he claims that computers are still more stupid than urinals.
Yeah.
And the reason why he says this is that if you stand in front of a urinal, it knows that you are there. If you're in front of a computer, it doesn't. And what he's trying to say with this is that the connectivity that we have between computers and the real world is still piss poor. So what we need is much more sensors and other things that make computers aware of its environment. So if I were to be at the BBC now and were asked to do a similar project to the BBC Micro, it would really be robots. Having small robots that you can actually program and make do things.
That was the creators of the BBC Micro at the Science Museum. So, Bobby, how much of an effect did this machine really have on the current technology industry?
I think the way to think about it is if a similar project happened now, what would happen? Well, for a start, you just can't imagine a similar project happening now because the scale of it would be so huge. They sold about 1.5 million BBC Micros in about a five-year time span, which, you know, that's not too shabby for the early 80s. If you tried to do the same thing now, say if the government or the BBC got involved in mobile phones or you know, a new computing technology, you'd suddenly have this immense impact right across society. And I think this helped bring people together with a sense of community, I think.
If it was happening today, it wouldn't be hardware, it would be software. And you might do it with data, which is what all the free data things we were talking about last week is about.
There were a few rumours early on in the web's life that the BBC would turn itself into an ISP or something like that. So you can kind of see you'd have to really do something structurally really important. I mean, the weird thing for me is that actually I'm probably just slightly too young for the BBC Micro. But even so, the immense number of people who were getting into programming, into gaming, when we look back on the golden age of the British software industry or British bedroom gaming industry, that's where it focused very much on the BBC.
Well, there's the BBC Micro versus the Sinclair Spectrum. And there's sort of two different camps of bedroom coders.
It's like, it's like Apple and Windows these days. But I was a ZX Spectrum person and the BBC Micro was sort of a bit too expensive or it was a bit sort of over there at the time. But I know people, even now, I know a guy who runs a serious web company who still runs RISC OS, the BBC Micro OS, to deal with all his internet and email and stuff because he knows that there's no trouble with viruses.
Doesn't it make you look back, though, and wonder where we got it so wrong? You know, at this early point in the life cycle of the computing industry, at least some of the really important home PCs were British. You know, where are we now?
In this country, yes. But speaking as somebody who grew up in the States, there was no whiff of a BBC Micro in that country. And I think that was a really interesting distinction. Certainly in the US, we talk a lot about, in games, we talk about the home consoles as an inspiration. Nintendo, Atari, those. But definitely it's had a huge impact on the UK industry. Thank you very much, Bobby, for going out to the Science Museum and playing. That must have been really, really
well,
difficult.
It was tough, hard work.
I know. Well, you know, you did have to learn about your forebears. You being too young to remember the BBC Micro.
I'm still in nappies.
We don't want to know about that.
No, but now. Oh, no, that's worse. Sorry. Yes, let's carry on. Move along swiftly.
What was that about internet memes? If you'd like to reminisce about your BBC Micro days, please do feel free. We're having a love-in on the Games blog about the BBC Micro at blogs.guardian.co.uk/games. At this point in the programme, we normally look to what you've been talking about on the blogs. But to be honest, with the short week that we had last week, there wasn't much to report on. However, we thought we'd take this opportunity to introduce another channel of communication between us and you, the hotline. Yes, you'll get the chance to rant just as much as we get to rant at you. And all you have to do is to phone our new Skype number, which is Guardian Tech Weekly. That's T-E-C-H. Weekly, and tell us what you think. This week's chosen subject is, has Clay Shirky drunk too much Web 2.0 Kool-Aid? That was provided to us by Bobby Johnson. Thank you very much for that inspiration.
I'm not making an editorial judgment. I'm just merely offering it.
Exactly, yeah. You're proffering, and I think that's fair enough. But don't let that limit you. You can tell us anything. For example, as per a comment that we had a couple of weeks ago, is it OS X or OS 10? Your thoughts on a... Your thoughts on a voice message, I
suppose.
That's
right. 10 marks the spot.
Yeah. So if you have anything to say about either of those things or anything else, please do get in touch with us on Skype at Guardian Tech Weekly, and we'll record you and put you in the show.
I'm James Randerson, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, we get a tour through biodiversity and conservationism with E.O. Wilson, the scientist who's been called Darwin's natural heir. Also in the show, we'll reveal why Michelangelo's David is feeling stressed. Plus,
education should, in my view, be lifelong. We should be seeking to learn and relearn, to keep up to date, to challenge our own assumptions, to reflect, and to change our minds when logic and the evidence compel.
Education, education, education. Philosopher A.C. Grayling gives us his thoughts on the science of learning. All this and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle explained through the medium of song. It's all in the latest Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
Charles, it's another week, another technology section. What's going in this week's paper?
Well, on the front page, we're going to examine femtocells, which are an interesting mobile phone development which will possibly increase the amount of data use that we make, but they live inside your house. FastFlux, which is a method used by botnets to keep phishing sites alive despite the best efforts of people to shut them down. And Technophile, we're looking at the black box Bluetooth speaker from Gear 4. We're looking at nanotube transistor radios, which aren't things with very, very small dials. They're actually a method which could be dramatic power savings for Wi-Fi. And in Free Our Data, we're looking at whether land registry surcharges could fund the Ordnance Survey. In Opinion, we have Seth Finkelstein on the question of whether Wikipedia has been trading sex for edits. Keith Stewart looks at ludic versus narrative, the never-ending story of gameplay. Vic Keegan on copyright. And Jack Schofield asks whether the time is really right for sub-notebooks such as the Acer Triple EPC, better known as the RM Minibook.
Next week, we're welcoming Jack Schofield into the studio, who will be casting a backwards glance at technology in our rearview mirror feature. We'll also hear from a man who promises to give you more internet bang for your buck. That's Jeff Ferry from Infinera. Great for downloading videos from YouTube. Expect that and so much more on next week's episode of Tech Weekly. Thanks very much to our podders, Charles, Bobby, and Jemima. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.